Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in Sociology on the New Books Network. We are
Ellis Jones, Assistant Professor of Sociology at Holy Cross College in Worcester, Massachusetts.
And Jerry Lemke, Emeritus Professor of Sociology at Holy Cross College. Our guests for this edition are Lynn Chancer and John Andrews, co-editors of The Unhappy Divorce of Sociology and Psychoanalysis. It's a new book from Palgrave Macmillan.
Lynn is Professor of Sociology at Hunter College and the Graduate Center of City University of New York. John is Assistant Professor of Sociology at Williams College.
The Unhappy Divorce is an edited volume. Neil Schmelzer, Nancy Chodorow, George Steinmetz, and Jeffrey Prager are among the authors of its 18 chapters.
We are very pleased to have Lynn and John with us for the next 50 minutes or so. Lynn will be leaving us in about 30 minutes for another commitment.
Welcome, Lynn, John, and listeners to the New Books Network.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Lynn and John, the word divorce in your title implies that sociology and psychoanalysis were once married. Some listeners might be surprised. Some might ask, when did sociology ever have anything to do with psychoanalysis? In the first chapter, the authors George Cavalletto and Catherine Silver answer that question with some surprising data. Would you summarize for us what they found?
Well, Lynn? I could start. John and maybe John will pick up, but George and Catherine did extensive archival research into the history of ASR and AJS. And what's very interesting and often forgotten is that a finding that they show actually graphically and quantitatively is that a rather surprising number of articles in AJS and ASR were about psychoanalysis.
Could I just interject that ASR is the American Review of Sociology. AJS is the American Journal of Sociology. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Right. The other one's the American Sociological Review. Those are the main established long-term historical journals of the discipline that are sort of taken as, like if you were studying the mainstream of the discipline, you might look at those two journals.
Sure.
And in the 40s and 50s, reflecting Talcott Parsons' influence at that time, who was a trained psychoanalyst as well as a sociologist, there were, George and Catherine found, a surprisingly large number of articles about psychoanalysis and sociology. And they tended to go up in number for a number of years and then started to decline again. John, would you want to add to that?
Yeah, and you know, I think Lynn is right to say that trend reflects the influence of Parsons in the field. And particularly Freud's influence on his theory of the personality system, as the superego, you know, keeping individuals in check with a conscience, was something that Parsons borrowed really from Freud. But the decline that happened in the 60s and 70s, I think, reflected the unfashionableness, I guess, of structural functionalism toward other sort of paradigms.
Let's go back. We want to come back to that, of course. That's kind of the core material in your book. But let's go back for a minute, if we can, back a little further in history, when sociology and psychoanalysis came together. When was that, and what were the circumstances that brought them together in the first place?
I would say that, you know, the spike happened, you know, post-war, which was also when, you know, a lot of analysts were immigrating to the United States. So, you know, there's that, the actual immigration of people.
But there was also an initial surge of interest between about 1912 and about 1925. There was a kind of a spike there too.
Yeah, and that follows Freud's first visit to the United States in, I think, what, 1906, 1905?
I think that's right, yeah.
So, and, you know, he presented his theory of infantile sexuality, which was very controversial. So I think it was just in academic discourse, whether positively or negatively, people were talking about it.
And I also think, I mean, toward the end, I mean, high school students and college students often read Freud's Civilization and Its Discontents, which, sure, of course, is trying in some way to bring together the social and the psychoanalytic, but over the problem of war. So
yeah,
maybe the years you're referring to after World War One, when 1914, and then Freud starts to turn to a little bit of writing about society and psychoanalysis because of the incredible devastation of World War One. And it's interesting, perhaps, that another spike of interest occurs after World War II, and well, part of what Parsons is influenced by, but never, in my opinion, unfortunately, comes to the United States all that much, but in some ways it does, is the Frankfurt School. And the Frankfurt School,
sure,
writers who do land in New York and become part of the New School, but their interest in how to put Marx and Freud together was spurred by the rise of Nazism. So perhaps huge social disasters raise a sense of we need more than just sociology. We have to understand the psyche in order to see what's going on in the world.
And particularly aggressive tendencies, you know, that Freud attributes to the death drive.
Right. And comes up with a death drive for the first time after the war.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it seems that psychoanalysis and sociology coming together was at its peak right around the 1950s. Why exactly was that? Is that just a kind of reaction to World War II? What exactly was psychoanalysis offering American sociology at the time that it wasn't finding elsewhere?
Well, I think John started to discuss that in talking about Parsons writing The Social System, drawing on his own psychoanalytic training as a psychoanalyst. So there was a sense of seeing sociology from Parsons, but also from the Frankfurt School, which of course Parsons knew of, as needing to engage with how the psyche and how the social interrelate in some way. For Parsons, feminists would later criticize him in terms of how he does that in the social system, but there still is this interest in psychoanalysis that it, in Parsons' time, was not seen, fascinatingly, as necessarily divorceable from sociology. And so that your reference to a quote-unquote marriage prior to a divorce is that there was more of an understanding, theoretically, of how can you understand the social if you don't understand the psyche in that period, with Parsons as maybe the more mainstream sociological figure bringing that about, but then also the Frankfurt School's influence doing that too.
So, you know, if in part psychoanalysis is riding on kind of Parsonian coattails in the 1950s, then how, what happens in the 60s and 70s when you have the Frankfurt School kind of coming more into vogue? The journal that it now called Critical Sociology used to be called the Insurgent Sociologist, emerging and really kind of displacing the Freudian presence in American sociology. How does that transition happen?
Yeah, well, interesting because it happens in numerous ways. It seems to me in George and Catherine's piece, what happens in George and Catherine's article is they trace the rise and fall and sort of show, I think in 1953, they look at particular articles in AJS and ASR that begin to attack the psychoanalytic. And the attacks on the psychoanalytic are about that it's not scientific enough, it's not falsifiable, it's not following a scientific method. So there's attacks on the, actually in George and Catherine's piece, the inability to operationalize, quote unquote, what you're studying when you're dealing with psychoanalysis. So one form of attack comes right within AJS and ASR because of the influence of science and the rise of a certain kind of American positivism. So that's one thing that happens.
Well,
it seems that there's if I could just make this one point, that there's something that also happens in the 60s, that you have Goffman, symbolic interactionism coming into vogue, and there is an attack, a sense, and the rise slowly into the 60s and 70s of feminism, identity politics, and there's a sense of Freud as conservative. Freud starts to be seen as part and labeled, and actually Parsons too in sociology, but as have it being essentialistic, not taking into account the fluidity of identity, that there's something politically, there's a political rebellion against Freud and a particular eco-psychology, more conservative reading of Freud. So that's the second thing that happens, like the rise of positivism and then also the rise of anti-institutional Goffmanian 60s belief that there's something essentialistic about the Freudian legacy.
It's really interesting because, you know, then what seems to be happening is that psychoanalysis first is attacked from the conservative flank as not being kind of scientific enough. And and then suddenly it gets also attacked in the 60s and 70s from the liberal flank. I have to say, that's fascinating. One of the things that really struck me in that early piece by Catherine Silver was the quotes that she was able to pull out of some of these articles, the vitriol in those. If I could just read one of them, it just struck me. One of the articles that they quote from says the following. One of the more persistent weeds in the social science garden is Freudianism.
Yeah.
It is an adaptable plant thriving without factual nourishment that returns season after season in one or another of its apparently infinite variations. Many have tried to hoe it out. Many have tried to smother it with the preponderance of contrary evidence. And some have endeavored to kill it with poisonous words. But so far the species has survived, and at the moment it is again flourishing at the expense of more useful and productive constructs. That, you know, that kind of language I thought, you know, was reserved in the modern news cycle for terrorist organizations. So to see it in a mainstream sociological journal in the 50s was just a kind of amazing anti-psychoanalytical propaganda almost.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, and
yeah.
I think we also have to recognize the sort of institutional forces that were happening in the 50s when, you know, sociology was really trying to establish itself, like Lynn said, as scientific, but also to receive university monies. And psychoanalysis was doing the same thing in a different arena, really more in the therapeutic. So
can you say more about that? I mean, I think in some ways that's really the kernel of the matter, you know, funding. Maybe you even know some things that you could say that are not in the book. Well, what kind of funding are we talking about? Who with what funds are pulling strings, right? And what constitutes the institutional strings there that you're talking about? Can you say more about that?
George and Catherine really are the experts here. So what I'm kind of speculating to some extent, but I think the funds that we're talking about are, you know, from universities, establishing a sociology separate from anthropology, separate from economics, that by separating itself from those other disciplines, including psychoanalysis, it could legitimate itself as a unique kind of knowledge. Mm-hmm.
There must have been some fierce committee battles within the ASA over some of these things. No? Questions maybe over control of journals, editing of journals?
Sure.
Yeah. Do we have any?
Editing the journals, et cetera. But I think what you're trying to get at, and there's probably other people who can answer this question better. I'm thinking of Kelly Moore, who's at Loyola University in Chicago, who studies sociology of science. But when you look at how and who is controlling grants, the rise of scientific research being funded by corporations, by government, different government agencies, and so, I mean, psychoanalysis just doesn't fit into that scientific agenda in the way that it is being funded. And there, it's also, to this day, I mean, we haven't yet talked about the present, but what's interesting about the beginning of the book is it charts the rise and fall, or quote-unquote marriage and quote-unquote divorce, which John and I just use those phrases metaphorically, but it's something happens where it starts to become marginalized with the rise of science, more funding over science, and various people up through even Pierre Bourdieu, who's written about here also, seeing sociology as a quote-unquote science, following scientific methods, and it's not clear where Freud fits into that. So to this day, one of the reasons I think the Freudian method and theory is still seen as on the outside of sociology is that it's not clear how that fits in methodologically with how you do research. So it raises all kinds of long-term questions, but I think this change was starting with, was correlated with the rise of a scientific method within sociology.
I just want to remind listeners that we're talking to Lynn Chancer and John Andrews, who are co-editors of the new book, The Unhappy Divorce of Sociology and Psychoanalysis. It's a new book out from Palgrave Macmillan. And Lynn is going to have to leave us in a few minutes for another commitment. And I want to make sure to ask her a couple of questions out of her chapter in the book. Lynn, you tell the story of the divorce between sociology and psychoanalysis, through the biographies of some American sociologists whose careers were lived through the years when the divorce occurred. Your chapter is entitled C. Wright Mills, Freud, and the Psychosocial Imagination. In your chapter, you remark on Mills' ambivalence towards Freud. Could you describe that ambivalence for us and listeners? And then maybe turning Mills on Mills, tell us what you find in Mills' personal biography that might explain that ambivalence toward Freud.
It seemed at the time intellectually, it's interesting to me that Mills could have been, but does not seem to have been as influenced by the Frankfurt School as one might think. He was in New York at Columbia. There were the Frankfurt School right downtown at the New School.
Sure.
But he goes more in the direction of the Columbia Department, the development through Merton of middle range theory. He's certainly influenced by other figures at Columbia, even though later in Mill's life he goes in a very much Marxist direction. But in the milieu of Columbia sociology that he was in, Freud was certainly, I mean, that was parcel of the divorce that was occurring, quote unquote. And so Mills, I think, but on the other hand, what's very important about Mills is Mills writes the sociological imagination, and Mills has this famous quote that every sociology student, undergraduate and graduate, comes to know about private troubles and putting together biography and the social.
Exactly.
And so somewhere Mills knows that you can't just get rid of the level of the individual agent in dealing with the structural. So he writes with Girth and Mills about how to put together the famous Girth and Mills volume, where he's looking at character structure. But what happens in that attempt by Mills to develop a social psychology, because that Girth and Mills volume, I think, was his main work in trying to do that, is my reading is that, well, it's not really even so much of a reading. When you look for mentions of Freud, there's maybe two in the entire volume. Hmm. It mostly starts to develop a tripartite mind, self, and society model that's very reminiscent of Mead, and I think is inaugurating in the 50s and 60s through the present a ongoing preference for symbolic interactionism as a framework to understand the individual in relation to the social more than the Freudian. So that seems to happen. But then when your question about turning Mills against Mills, I argue also that one thing that might have made the Freudian Freudian theory, Freudian method, alien to sociologists is that Mills dies before the rise of feminism occurs. And the rise of feminist theory begins to, from another very, very important angle, i.e. gender, and the bifurcation between socialized femininity and masculinity, suddenly asks, well, what's the relationship between the inner and the outer, the private and the public, the emotional and the rational. Mills doesn't live to see that, and had he seen that, he might have found Freudianism, which calls your attention inward, a little bit more interesting. So there's a big, big difference between something like symbolic interaction or like the popularity now of Bourdieu within sociology, that if you look at Freud starts from within, from oneself, and looks at one's own psyche. It's very, very introspective, obviously. That was the basis, as I say in that essay, of the general interpretation of dreams, was Freud's own dreams. And until feminism and other questioning of methodologies starts to happen later, I think a method that looks inward is not going to be so popular in sociology as it developed in America.
You know, one thing that struck me with this particular book is that, on the one hand, it's talking about something fairly specific about the relationship between psychoanalysis and sociology. But in that divorce, there are mentions of other divorces, potentially, that really, in some ways, the book is about this emerging hegemony of positivism that we're still wrestling with the fallout of to this day. Can you talk a little bit more about that hegemony of positivism and maybe even mention a few of the other divorces that may have taken place along the way?
John, would you like to give that one a try?
Sure. I think that, you know, even though there was this, you know, quote-unquote divorce, you still see references to Freud and psychoanalysis throughout the 60s, 70s, and up through today. I mean, Nancy Chodorow comes to mind, of course, but Louis Althusser in France was deeply influenced by Lacan. But to talk about the other kinds of divorces, I think that those really came about beginning with feminism, but also other kind of minoritarian perspectives, critical race theory, queer theory, are all wrestling against positivism in different ways, and also have, at the same time, a kind of vexed relationship with psychoanalysis.
Yeah.
So there's the divorce is very muddled, I guess. Lynn, do you?
Yeah, I mean that.
Do you agree
that
with
makes
that?
Sense. But when you're saying that, when you were talking about the volume has various debates going on within the volume, which I found very interesting in the course of editing it. And the subtitle, Diverse Perspectives on the Psychosocial, is, I think, a very, very accurate description of the book, because what the authors all have in common is, I think, a very strongly agreed upon sense that it's just impossible to somehow understand the social without taking the internal and the external, the psychic and the cultural, both into account. So everyone agrees on that, but then there's a tremendous amount of diversity in terms of how does one go about that. And so one debate, I don't know if I would want to use the word divorce, but I think there's lively debates going on in that book. So, for example, Neil Smelser, who you mentioned, I think, Jerry, in introducing the book, he has, I think, a wonderfully thorough, very systematic article about his own training as a psychoanalyst and his being a sociologist. But he comes up with a kind of limited view of where you can put the psycho and the social together. And then there's C.M.A.C. Moivet. Excuse me?
And a pessimistic, too, I would say.
Yeah, a little bit pessimistic. He doesn't rule it out altogether, but he gives it the areas where one can apply it, he finds very limited. And then C.M.A.C. Moivet has a very passionate, engaged essay where he's saying that the language of psychoanalysis and the language of sociology, that there are concepts that are kindred concepts that are being used all the time. So we could say that's a more optimistic view that of that ability to reconcile sociology and psychoanalysis. And then there's, you know, Neil McLaughlin, I think, is following a little bit on Smelser and saying, okay, let me give three examples of where you might be able to use this productively. And another wonderful essay, I think, in the book is Gilda Zwerman's essay where she called Personae, based on the Bergman film, where she talks about that there's always a inner psychoanalytic dimension to how one picks research topics, sociological topics. It's not this objective thing at all. Mm-hmm. So it's almost going back to Weber and developing that. And then John could talk about his essay where he uses foreclosures. Various people have essays where they take a term that's getting used in both a social and psychoanalytic way and elaborate that connection. Mm-hmm. So maybe, John, can you say something about that?
Well, we definitely want to come back to that. Lynn, you have to go.
I have to sign off.
Right?
Yeah.
There's one other thing, kind of an aside, but I can't resist this. Alice and I read the book independently of each other, and then when we got together to talk about it, we both we both, almost the first thing that each of us said was that the book seems to do a psychoanalysis of sociology.
Yeah.
We both had it in our notes, actually, with question marks. And I wanted, before you go, Lynn, and then John can follow up too, but to ask you what you think of that, what you make of that.
That observation.
Yeah, it sort of echoes the old phrase sociology of sociology, which
was certainly
one of the radical sociology impetuses.
Definitely.
Yeah, what do you think?
Well, it's a very interesting observation, and at some level, I think there definitely is that dimension, and was for me, in that I love doing sociology, I love doing sociological theory, but as someone who's been in the field for 25, 30 years, something I find interesting is that if a student came up to me and asked me for 5 books of sociologists writing about their own dynamics as sociologists, there is very, very little of that I'm aware of. It's not completely absent. But, you know, we study social groups, but not so much our own interactions with each other. Mm. That's why when I was talking about Mills and saying how Freud starts from within. So in some ways it would certainly make sense for sociologists to be studying each other. Mm-hmm. So then from that question it comes, well, why is that? You know, and is there an unconsciousness about our own social processes?
A collective unconscious.
Yeah,
As in sociology, a disciplinary.
A disciplinary unconscious.
Exactly.
And what I was also just following up from that I find fascinating about that unconscious, you know, if you want to call it a sociological unconsciousness of itself, that what I continue to make this argument, at least of interest to me, that I think that major, major theorists, Durkheim, Marx, and Weber, among them, all in some part of their classical theoretical arguments are asserting unconscious group processes. Mm-hmm. So that ideology for Marx, you're not conscious, right? The argument is you're not conscious of your actual quote unquote interests. And whatever one thinks about that claim, there still is an assertion of a collective kind of unconsciousness. Similarly, Durkheim writing about crime, Weber
Absolutely.
Writing about the Protestant. So there is unconsciousness in sociology all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
So I was at some level with John in this book attempting to bring that a kind of marginalized or repressed aspect of sociology more to the forefront.
Hmm. Great. Terrific.
Interesting stuff.
Okay. So very nice talking to you. Thank you so much for having this discussion with us.
Yes. Well, thank you for taking the time. And,
okay.
And we'll continue on now with John. Right.
Okay. Bye now.
To follow up with what Lynn just said.
Sure.
I think it's also noteworthy, I guess, that a number of the authors in the book are also trained as analysts.
Yes, that's interesting.
Including Catherine Silver, Smelzer, Jeff Prager.
Yes.
So, and a number of us have also been analysts. So I think that personal experience informs how we do sociology as well.
Mm-hmm. That the sociologists who are trained as analysts, those whom I know are older. Some of them came into the discipline in the late 50s and in the 60s. Is there a younger generation of sociologists who have gone through training?
It's interesting. I mean, CMAC, Mohivety, is probably the youngest of the trained analysts, but to my knowledge, I think you're correct that sociologists who end up doing training tend to do so later in life.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know. I know that for Catherine, I'll speak for her, that it came out of a certain frustration in doing sociology and its refusal to acknowledge, I guess, unconscious processes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, John, let's get back to your chapter. It has a great title, Foreclosure from Freud to Fannie Mae. And as the title suggests, it's not only is Freud relevant in 21st century America, but there's this distinction of the term, the Freudian use and the common use of the term foreclosure, mm-hmm. Which is more in this day and age used to reference the housing loan crisis. Can you just give us a little bit of that back and forth distinction and what you were working with that term?
Yeah, well, you know, I think it's, well, one of the, before I answer that question, I'll say that a lot of us are using these Freudian concepts in non-psychoanalytic ways, like foreclosure,
mm-hmm.
and it becomes, or melancholia, or, you know, repression, they become hermeneutic, I guess, for interpreting social phenomenon that isn't quantifiable or that you couldn't necessarily observe. So what interested me about the housing crisis was this phenomenon of former homeowners destroying their homes before they vacated the house, and many to very, very extreme measures, you know, leaving ferrets, feces, ripping out moldings. So I asked, you know, what was going on in their minds when this happened, you know, and there's no way to go to trace these people. There's, you know, sociologically, all we have is the trace of the home itself. So to me, foreclosure was more of an interpretive device for thinking about inside and outside of the home, of the mind, and I think that others, like Anthony Elliott, Jeff Prager, use melancholia maybe in a similar kind of way.
Well, what's the Freudian use of foreclosure?
Well, Freud used the term, it's usually translated as repudiation. And it was Lacan who really developed that concept. And for Freud, repudiation or foreclosure dealt with aspects of the world that the psyche refuses to even acknowledge. It's unbearable. Hmm. So it's foreclosed ideas or feelings are not repressed. They don't even enter consciousness. So that to me it's rather unique in psychoanalysis because it's talking about a kind of radical exterior that's unaccountable or that we can't account for.
Hmm. The term denial comes to mind.
Yeah, I think that's
more
probably
a common expression.
Denial. Yeah. But even denial seems to suggest that at some level you're aware of whatever it is that's being denied. You know, like if you're an alcoholic who's in denial or whatever. So foreclosure it takes that to a, you know, I guess it takes it further.
Hmm. And then sort of coming back again to foreclosure, the way we use it in terms of the housing loan crisis is Is it are you meaning to say then that there are levels of hostility that are there, but that that kind of go unaccounted for?
Well, I think historically,
But that then come out in the form of the trashing of these houses.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think that on the financial side, it's these predatory loans, the subprime loans, that people who borrow aren't necessarily aware of what is happening behind the scenes when banks lend the money knowing that they're going to fail because they're, bundled together and securitized and sold to some other financial institution. It's sort of a weird kind of almost Ponzi-like scheme. So it's sort of an outside that individual homeowners aren't aware of the financial, underpinning of the money that they've been loaned.
It brings me to another, I think, related question, which is by investigating these various psychoanalytical and particularly Freudian insights and terms, is that investigation, do you think that might lead to social change different strategies or maybe even different policy decisions that vary from what we kind of currently have to engage some of these issues today?
Can you rephrase the question?
Sure. Does it kind of lead us into a new direction and just discovering new strategies to engage? Like if we understand, for example, that these people, through the use of an understanding of the term foreclosure in this context, that there's something else going on. Does it then reveal something new that we could then bring to bear that knowledge to kind of help our society kind of engage more directly and resolve some of these issues in a more creative way?
Can I reword that even further?
Sure.
What do we get out of a psychoanalytic influenced sociology that we don't get out of the positivist kind of sociology that is dominant in America today? What difference would it make in terms of policy directions, strategies and tactics and so forth?
Yeah, I think that what you get is depth, pulling people, you're limiting them to certain sort of preordained yes or no kind of questions. And psychoanalysis is about depth. It's about interiority. So if, we can understand motivation, which is sort of the core of what Freud was investigating in the unconscious, what motivates us, then we can better understand things like violence, terrorism, religious extremism, the things that are maybe troubling to us, gun violence, racism. So
apathy and passivity. Perhaps?
Yeah, I mean, that apathy and passivity, I think that, as Lynn pointed out, there's certain ideological forces that keep us in the status quo. So we believe in the system, we believe in the state, or the family, that these are natural sort of institutions. So I think in that sense, psychoanalysis is very germane to to understanding ideology, which, as we know, is, you know, in this day and age, you know, you have increasing nationalisms, extremisms of different sorts, but also, like you pointed out, kind of a belief that the world is as it is. And, you know, so if we understand the basis of ideology, then we can also understand how to motivate change.
Mm-hmm. What about your students? How do they approach these ideas? Are they fairly open to kind of Freudian concepts and psychoanalytic ideas, or are they resistant?
I have found that they are surprisingly very open. I mean, I think it's at first sort of shocking in a way to them, particularly the sexuality aspect. But they're very open to it. At the same time, I would say they don't quite know what to do with it either. So they have difficulty writing about Freud and the unconscious. And that may have to do with, you know, a certain level of world experience or maturity, you know, that, you know, most, you know, college students have just left the family, which is, of course, you know, for Freud, the basis of psychic formation is, you know, identification with the mother and the father and so forth.
Do you teach a course on Freudian theory in sociology?
I haven't, but I include Freud in my classical sociological theory, which
good for you.
Fortunately, they let me do that, and so we, you know, we do the Marx, Weber, Durkheim, but we also do we read Mead and Freud side by side. Hmm. Because I think Mead, as Lynn pointed out, was sort of, of course, he doesn't acknowledge Freud and was maybe a precursor to, or wasn't aware necessarily, but there's a lot of resonance, I guess, between the two theories of the self.
Hmm. Have you had enough time yet to have feedback on the book? Or conversations, interviews, you know,
reviews
to know, is there a pushback against your ideas? Is there any sense that the discipline is threatened by a resurgence of Freudian influence?
I have not heard feedback yet. The book wasn't out at ASA in August, so we may hear something this year.
Mm-hmm. Might be a picket line at the booth.
I don't, you know, yeah. Psychoanalysis and psychosocial approaches have made a big resurgence in the UK. Mm-hmm. And there's even a section for the psychosocial. They call it a stream, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think that the sociological establishment, if you want to call it that, is going to be too threatened.
Mm-hmm.
I think it will be of interest to sociologists and students who are already maybe interested in Freud.
And what about students that actually become interested in these Freudian ideas mixed with their sociological training or background? Are there programs, graduate programs, that they might be interested in becoming a part of? Are there any that you've identified that seem to have a strong Freudian influence?
Well, the Graduate Center, where I got my PhD, was one such place with Lynn, Stanley Aronowitz, and Patricia Clough, and Catherine Silver, all very well-versed in psychoanalysis. I would, you know, if I had a student who's interested in pursuing that kind of approach, I would probably steer them to American studies or some sort of interdisciplinary field, because I don't think that they will find a very receptive, audience in theology, at least for graduate school.
Certainly.
Okay, John. Let's wrap it up with that.
Okay. And, thank you so much.
Sure. Well, thanks for the time that you and Lynn have given us. Again, just a reminder to listeners that we've been talking to Lynn Chancer and John Andrews about their new book, The Unhappy Divorce of Sociology and Psychoanalysis, a new book from Palgrave Macmillan. Thanks again, John.
Thank you.
Good talking to you.
Okay. Bye-bye.